Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm David Holloway. I'm a professor of history and political science at Stanford and a member of the Center for International Security and Cooperation there and the moderator for your program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. And now I'm pleased to introduce today's program. When it comes to the subject of nuclear weapons, it is tempting to believe that now that the Cold War is over, the threats of nuclear war, the nuclear danger has ended, and that there are enough plans in place to prevent nuclear catastrophe. Sadly, this is not the case. Multiple nuclear nightmares still haunt us, from the thousands of Russian and American missiles that could accidentally be launched at a moment's notice, to tensions between countries such as India and Pakistan that could set off a regional nuclear war, to terrorists who could steal nuclear material and set off a bomb in a major city. Right now, there are 17,000 nuclear weapons in the world, held by 9 countries. 95% of those weapons are possessed by the United States and Russia. And most of those weapons, the overwhelming majority of those weapons, are more powerful, many times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So today, apart from providing new information about the dangers surrounding nuclear weapons in the United States, and also the dangers arising out of the proliferation of these weapons around the world, our guests will discuss what steps might be taken to reduce these dangers. We have 2 distinguished speakers. It's a great pleasure for me and a privilege to introduce them. Joe Cerencioni is president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and author of the book Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Mr. Cerencioni is a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board and of the Council on Foreign Relations. He worked for 9 years in the U.S. House of Representatives on the professional staff of the Committee on Armed Services and Government Operations, and is the author of 3 books and hundreds of articles on nuclear weapons issues. And besides his other responsibilities at Plowshares, he teaches at the Graduate School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Eric Schlosser is a noted journalist and author of the book Command and Control. As an investigative journalist and playwright, Mr. Schlosser tries to explore subjects ignored by the mainstream media and give a voice to people at the margins of society. Over the years, he's followed the harvest with migrant farm workers in California, spent time with meat packers in Texas and Colorado, and visited prisons throughout the United States. His work defies easy categorization, earning praise not only from liberal publications like The Nation, but also from Fortune, the Financial Times, and the National Review. Mr. Schlosser's first book, Fast Food Nation, helped start a revolution in how Americans think about what they eat. His new book, Command and Control, examines the efforts of the military to prevent nuclear weapons from being stolen, sabotaged, or detonated by accident. These are 2 men who have thought very hard about nuclear weapons, who have thought, driven their minds into what Winston Churchill called these hideous spheres of thought. And so please join me in welcoming them here this evening. I'd like to start with a question to both, first to Eric Schlosser and then Joe Serencioni, to allow them to kind of state their, in a way, their brief basic argument. Eric Schlosser quotes in his book a statement by General Lee Butler, who was the head of Strategic Air Command. And I quote, this was something Butler said in the early 1990s, "We escaped the Cold War without a nuclear holocaust. By some combination of skill, luck, and divine intervention, and I suspect the latter in greatest proportion." So my question is, do you agree with General Butler, and indeed with his estimate of the relative role of skill, luck, and divine intervention in the fact that we got through the Cold War? And do you think that we can rely on the same combination to escape the nuclear dangers that we face today? Eric?
I have great respect for General Butler, who was the last general to head the Strategic Air Command, and who made a real point, as his predecessors had not done, of looking at every target in the Soviet Union at which we were aiming our weapons. And I think he was overwhelmed by the experience, looking at the madness of overkill and the extraordinary damage that would have been done from a nuclear exchange. And I'd add one other thing into that mix that he doesn't mention, which is extraordinary personal courage and heroism and patriotism. The book that I've written is about the management of our nuclear arsenal, really from the Trinity test through the end of the Cold War. And many of the books written about nuclear weapons have focused on the high-level physicists of the Manhattan Project or on nuclear diplomacy. And I chose to focus on the personnel who were responsible in a day-in, day-out way for the management of our weapons. So I spent time with launch crews who'd been in the underground silos ready to fire our missiles, bomber crews who risked their lives every time they went on a mission, an airborne alert mission. I interviewed weapons designers and nuclear weapon repairmen and even bomb squad officers whose expertise would be to defuse a damaged nuclear weapon. The book I wrote is very critical of many aspects of the management of our arsenal, but at the same time we have to acknowledge the United States has built perhaps 70,000 nuclear weapons, and to my knowledge, none of them ever detonated accidentally. They were exposed to fires, they were submerged, there were short circuits, they were involved in plane crashes and truck crashes, and none of them detonated accidentally. So we have to start by saying we have to acknowledge and respect the technical expertise of the people who worked on these weapons. Secondly, as I said earlier, enormous personal heroism. I think we've really honored the veterans of the Second World War, the Greatest Generation. We've honored the Korean War veterans belatedly and the Vietnam War veterans. But there's been very little acknowledgement of the Cold War veterans. And in my book, I use as a central narrative a nuclear weapons accident in Damascus, Arkansas, involving the most powerful nuclear warhead that we ever put on a missile and a fuel leak in that missile that could have led to a catastrophe in Arkansas. And it was young men, young airmen, age 20, 21, 23, 25, who risked their lives. One of them lost his life trying to prevent this nuclear catastrophe. And in going through these other accidents, I talk about incredible personal heroism, young men losing their lives in a way I think that has to be respected and hasn't been acknowledged. And having said all that, I think there was a remarkable amount of good fortune that prevented an accidental nuclear detonation. Nuclear weapons are machines. They're highly complex machines. And like all machines, they eventually go wrong. And when nuclear weapons are attached to other machines, like launch delivery vehicles, missiles, or bombers, and those are connected to communication systems and computers, the potential for a catastrophic error is enormous. It's hard to imagine fallible human beings creating a system that's infallible.
So when you're talking about nuclear weapons accidents or the possibility of an accidental detonation, it's a low probability event, but low probability events happen in life. And just the laws of probability would dictate the longer you have a large number of nuclear weapons, the odds are going to be high that one of them is going to go off by accident, one of them is going to be stolen, one of them is going to be used by someone without the proper authorization. And I'd like to think that the book I wrote is purely of historical interest, but unfortunately the same sort of management issues that we faced in the Cold War are being faced by the government and the military of Pakistan, of India, of Russia, of North Korea, and even now in the United States, where our weapon systems are aging, where there's very low morale in the nuclear enterprise, and where some of our top generals seem to have gambling and alcohol issues. So this problem never went away, and I would not cite divine intervention, but I do think we were lucky, and there's no guarantee that that luck will last.
Right. Thank you. Joe.
Thank you very much. Thank you, David, and thank you for moderating this panel. And I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club, and particularly its head, Gloria Duffy, for allowing us to speak here today. It's a real pleasure. I would guess that very few of you, with the possible exception of Secretary Shultz here today, woke up this morning thinking about nuclear weapons. And why would you? As David said in his opening comment, these are things of the past. Aren't we done with this? What relevance do they have to our contemporary world except to stop other people from getting them? And maybe you thought, woke up with some happy thoughts, that you were wise enough to live on the West Coast instead of the frozen East Coast. Or maybe if you had problems that you were thinking about, they're probably family problems or maybe community problems. But of all the issues that we face, all the challenges that we face in our family, in our state, in our nation, there really are only two that threaten destruction at a planetary level. And those are the issues of global warming and nuclear weapons. Both of these are caused by machines that we built. Both of these threaten to destroy everything else that we built. Global warming slowly and nuclear weapons instantaneously. But both of these are threats that can be reduced, reversed, and maybe even eliminated. But both of them require a new way of thinking and new political leadership with the courage to act. Because when you try to act on one of these issues, you run up against something else they both have in common, which is a host of deniers. People who deny there's a problem or are proposing policies that would actually make the current situation even worse. So you have to understand that this is not a dry academic discussion, that this is a living political policy debate. As President Obama said in his seminal speech on nuclear policy in Prague, in April 2009, you need to have the voices of peace be as loud as those on the other side. We've got to be as passionate and as dedicated and as knowledgeable about these issues as those who are proposing policies that would make our situation worse. And I got to tell you, if there's only one book that you want to buy on nuclear policy, it should be Command and Control. I think that Eric has written an instant classic. This is easily one of the best books I've ever read on this, and it helps explain how we got here. How did we get to a place where we built 70,000 nuclear weapons? Where the United States had 30,000 at one time, and the Soviet Union had 30,000 at one time. How are we still in a place where we have 5,000 nuclear weapons in our arsenal? And Eric's careful history in a very dramatic way helps you understand the step-by-step policy choices that we made that led us into this utter madness. If you're going to buy two books on the subject.
I was going to interrupt. I just met Joe. I just met Joe a couple of hours ago, and his book is not only wonderful, but it's much shorter.
It could fit inside the jacket here of this. Because Nuclear Nightmare sort of picks up where Eric's book ends, and it brings you up to the current moment. And it's really a story of President Obama's efforts to change the policies we have, to eliminate these triple threats of nuclear terrorism, of the spread of these weapons to new, more unstable countries, or the risk that one of the existing weapons will be used, as the man said, by miscalculation or accident or madness. And the reason we're here today and talking is not just of a historic significance, is because that policy initiative that Obama articulated that took the work and the policy recommendations of George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and Bill Perry and translated it into a practical set of near-term steps and a compelling vision, that policy initiative has stalled out. After the first 2 years of administration, that nuclear policy is basically flatlined in this administration. And the struggle now is, how do you restart it? How do you get back on track so we can reduce the weapons? These are the current issues that we're facing. And for my money, there are no more important issues than what we do now today to prevent a nuclear threat tomorrow.
Right. Thank you very much. Joe, I'm getting many questions here from the
audience.
We just started.
How can I have so many questions?
But let me raise this question. The two books, different though they are, one more historical, one more devoted to current issues, they are both, in a sense, books that seek to alert people to the dangers, right? Eric, you write that each missile is an accident waiting to happen, I think, at one point. And Joe, you point to nuclear nightmares. And when I said it was tempting not to think the danger had passed, I don't fall for that temptation. But it looks as though you have a sense that people don't quite get it, don't understand just how dangerous the situation is. And my question then is, why don't people get it? Why don't they see it as being as dangerous as it really is?
About half the population of the United States either was not yet born or were small children when the Soviet Union collapsed. Mm. So there's half of the population has no memory of the great existential threat and terror that was ever present throughout the Cold War. And then among the other 50%, the collapse and disappearance of the Soviet Union was such an extraordinary historical event that no one could have imagined decades earlier. And the fact that the Soviet Union could vanish without a Third World War was so remarkable that I think there was a feeling the problem had been solved and that the problem went away. And particularly in the decade after the ending of the Cold War, there was almost a feeling that nobody wanted to hear about it anymore. Remarkable documents were declassified. I think there was just a fatigue. It's over. Some people felt we won, but in any event, the threat went away. But it never went away. And there's also what Joe mentioned, a sense of denial. There's a sense of, this is such a big problem, I don't want to think about it. It's such a big problem, what can I do about it? And as Joe was talking, I was thinking about, well, very recently Nelson Mandela passed away. And when I was born, the notion that Nelson Mandela would walk free from Robben Island, be president of a free South Africa without an all-out race war, be friends with his jailer, was so inconceivable. And yet it happened. And so when you think about greatly reducing or eliminating the threat of nuclear weapons now, it seems like such a massive and unrealistic undertaking. And yet, I feel like it's possible. And history can turn in a dark way, or history can turn in a remarkable way. And Secretary of State Shultz was involved personally in some of that miraculous turn, in having President Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev sit and shake hands and honestly discuss the elimination of nuclear weapons, which would have been an inconceivable conversation just 2 or 3 years earlier. So I think, you know, I know why I wrote my book, and Joe has his reasons. I wrote my book as a way to try to pierce through this denial and remind people these weapons still exist, the dangers still exist, because I think before you can have any change, you need an awareness. And once that awareness begins, action can follow.
Joe, do you want to take this up?
Two minutes to add to this. Something also has changed in the last couple of years, I think, that's going to help us on this issue of dealing and dispelling these nuclear nightmares, at least reducing the risk of them. And that is, in addition to the risk of a terrorist using this or a new state getting them or somebody using one of the existing weapons, we now have another risk that's been added, another nightmare that we have, and that's the fiscal nightmare of how much these weapons cost. So even if you think this is so improbable that I don't have to worry about their use or it's such a big problem that I can't do anything about it, think how much this is going to cost you, your children, and your grandchildren. There are two new studies out. One is by the Congressional Budget Office that estimates that over the next 10 years, the United States is going to spend $355 billion on its nuclear forces. $355 billion. But wait, that's actually the good news, because the prices increase dramatically after the next 10 years. It's like a balloon mortgage, that the money you're paying over the next 10 years is actually a small percentage. There's a new study out by the Monterey Institute, a California think tank here, that estimates we're going to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years on nuclear weapons and their related programs. And that is because all the nuclear weapons that we built during the Cold War, they're now reaching the end of their operational life. They're retiring. And the incredible military-industrial machine we created to build these weapons is still going. And it's doing its job. It's replicating these weapons. It's coming up with programs to replace them. This is what we told these people to do. They're not doing anything against government policy. This is our government policy. Nobody has told them to stop yet. And the contracts are moving their way through Congress, racing ahead of any policy decisions on how many do we need. So in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to make 50-year decisions. In the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to decide on building a new generation of submarines, bombers, and missiles that all told are going to cost us $1 trillion. Is this where you want your tax dollars to go? If it's not, it's time to let our elected representatives know what we do want.
A number of people have sent up this question. Given how dangerous these weapons are, given the nuclear nightmares that exist, why is it so difficult to get rid of them?
Yeah. Okay, let me start with that.
Okay.
I think there's several elements here, and one is ideological. And Senator Richard Lugar, who led the campaign in the Senate with then-Senator Kerry to ratify the New START agreement. When he got to the floor, he spoke directly to his Republican colleagues, and he says, I know there are some people here who will never vote to ratify an arms control treaty. You have an ideological opposition. There are some people who think ideologically arms control treaties are a bad idea, large nuclear arsenals are a good idea. So that's one base of support. The other is political. I mean, one of the things we've learned is that Republicans do arms control better than Democrats. Republican presidents, the last three Republican presidents, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, have each cut the nuclear arsenal 50%, whereas President Bill Clinton, marginal cuts. President Obama barely nicked the number of nuclear weapons, barely reduced it, because political opponents in the Senate, in the body politic, oppose a Democrat when he does this, and politics of the Democratic Party support a Republican president when he does this. So you have that political thing. But I think the real reason, and I'll stop here, is basically money. That what you have is vested groups who profit from contracts and jobs on the existing programs, and they keep them going. It's not all that many jobs in Montana that are devoted to the 150 ICBMs that are there, but for the two senators of Montana, those 2,000 jobs matter a lot. And so they defend their bases. So they have something called the ICBM caucus in the Senate that is opposing any reductions mandated by the New START Treaty, proposing any trimming of the 450 ICBMs that we have. As long as that is not opposed, as long as there's not a political force that opposes that, those kind of economic interests will prevail.
I think there's also a mindset, a Cold War mindset. There was never a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the freedom of Western Europe was preserved. And the freedom of Berlin was preserved. And nuclear weapons played a real role in that. And so there's a reluctance now to let go of weapons which were seen to have been so useful. But it's sort of a mentality that followed the First World War, in which the battleship was seen as this essential weapon, and yet in the Second World War was basically a weapon that was very easily sunk. Nuclear weapons are irrelevant to 21st century warfare. And one of the arguments of my book is that these weapons pose a grave danger to any country that chooses to possess them. Without being too jingoistic, I think that we probably build the safest, most technologically advanced nuclear weapons in the world. We invented this technology. We perfected it. We probably have the best command and control equipment. And yet, if we've come this close repeatedly, as I describe in my book, to having our own weapons detonate on our own soil and kill our own civilians, think about Pakistan. Think about India. Think about Russia. You look at their level and rate of industrial accidents. These are highly complex technologies to manage. And if I were to be able to sit down with the leadership of Iran, I would make a strong argument that it's not in Iran's interest to have nuclear weapons and that they will be at greater danger by having them, not only because of their own weapons, but because of the greater likelihood they'll be attacked by having them. So there is a mid-20th century mentality, a mindset that cannot let go of these totems of power, these symbols of international power. And yet, you know, I think the reality is they're a grave danger and not a source of national security.
How far is U.S. policy constrained by the fact that other countries have nuclear weapons? We've focused so far on U.S. policy, the obstacles in the U.S. to getting rid of nuclear weapons. But how important is it that Russia has a similar number, China has a smaller number, Britain, France, India, Pakistan, North Korea? How do you see the relationship between what the U.S. does and what the other countries do? Because there'll be many people who say, well, yes, of course, we should get rid of nuclear weapons as long as everyone else gets rid of them. And there are some who say we will get rid of nuclear weapons and nobody will pay any attention. They'll just go on, you know, doing what they want to do.
I think every responsible expert in this field advocates mutual, balanced, verifiable reductions. So you don't go this alone. Nobody's talking about unilateral disarmament. Nobody's talking about us giving up our nuclear weapons and then seeing what happens. You know, it's got to be done in a balanced way. And the two countries that have to take the lead are the United States and Russia. Between us, we have 95% of all the nuclear weapons in the world. So we're the only two countries that number our weapons by the thousands. Everybody else counts them by the dozens. So the other countries aren't going to move very much on any kind of serious reductions until they see the United States and Russia are serious. And frankly, the problem right now is Russia. For all the things we just talked about why the U.S. has so many weapons, if Russia would agree to further reductions, we could quickly move ahead to accelerate the reductions that are called for under the New START Treaty, but the New START Treaty is a ceiling. It's not a floor. It says you can't have more than 1,550 deployed strategic weapons, but you can have fewer. You could drop to 1,000. The president has declared in his national nuclear guidance policy, that the Joint Chiefs agree we don't need all the weapons that were allowed under this treaty. We could go down to 1,000 weapons if the Russians would go along with us. It would make it much easier. That's the struggle over the next couple of years to see if we can get the Russians to take that step with us.
And I agree with that. And I'd like to ask you about the Russian attachment to nuclear weapons, because throughout the Cold War, the United States was so demonized as the main engine of the arms race, and yet now we really do have an administration that seems sincerely committed, if not to abolition immediately, to large-scale reductions, and yet suddenly you have Russia modernizing its forces and being quite open about how they might use nuclear weapons in conventional situations. And so what is it about the Russian mentality right now that's put so much importance on their arsenal? One of the great experts on the Soviet nuclear armament system.
I think it actually comes back to, I think it comes to two things. One is there is a military argument that since their armed forces fell to pieces, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, their conventional forces are immensely weak, and therefore they need to have nuclear weapons, especially the tactical nuclear weapons, non-strategic weapons, to compensate for that weakness. And that's a major argument that's made. And you can argue it, you know, disagree or agree with it. But I think it also comes back to something that you said, Eric, and that is the symbolism of the weapons and the way in which the identity of the state and the kind of narrative of what the particular state is about is tied up with the nuclear program. And that's very strong in the Soviet Union, or in, I should say, in post-Soviet Russia, in part because they look back at their nuclear program and their missile and space program as something that they did really well. They competed with the United States, since, you know, they were the first man in space and so on. Okay, they didn't get to the moon, but nevertheless, they're very proud of that. And somehow the notion that you would then have a vision of Russia that pushed nuclear weapons aside and the missiles aside, I think involves a real break, an even greater break with Soviet history, which many of those who regret the breakup of the Soviet Union do not want to see. So I agree with you. There's this psychological element, this symbolic element, and the element of mentality, which I think comes into this in a very strong way.
Well, you know, it may take a serious accident to persuade them otherwise, because they had a fire in one of their ballistic missile submarines a few years ago, and initially they claimed there were no missiles and there were no warheads on the sub, but there actually were, I think, 16 missiles with multiple warheads, and the fire burned for hours, and they had to literally submerge the submarine to put it out. And in the same way that Chernobyl raised questions about their reliance on certain types of nuclear power, a serious nuclear weapons accident could have the same impact in Russia, and I hope it doesn't come to that as a persuasive force.
I just make one point. Yes, they've had a number of very serious accidents with their nuclear missile submarines, but as far as we know, and I think we would know, they also have not had an accident where a nuclear weapon detonated, where you had a nuclear explosion. In fact, no country has had, and I assume that we would know that. Mm-hmm. And that's remarkable. Especially taking account of the things you said about, you know, rates of industrial accidents and so on in Russia.
And that means one of two things. It means it's absolutely impossible for a nuclear weapon to detonate accidentally, or it means statistically it's more likely to happen tomorrow because it hasn't happened.
That's true.
No, we toss a coin every day, and it's always 50%. So here's a question. How many nuclear weapons should the United States have until should we completely disarm if other countries have not set a precedent? Now, I think you've answered that in part,
yeah.
Joe, but there's still an issue about how if you have nuclear weapons and rely on them to do certain things like provide deterrence, what kind of nuclear force would you have?
So there's two ways to look at this. One is how many do we have and how many can we safely get rid of? I prefer to look at it from the bottom up. How many do we need? I can't think of any military mission that requires the use of one nuclear weapon. There hasn't been for over 68 years. And we have been in some tough situations where our forces were threatened, our allies were threatened. We have lost wars, and we have not used nuclear weapons. No country has. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we should have 10. Okay, 50. No, 500. Let's have 500 nuclear weapons. We have 5,000. So that gives you some idea of how far you can reduce, once you start thinking of it that way, from the insane levels that we still have as a vestige of these Cold War doctrines. And, in fact, many, many independent studies have come out suggesting that we have a force of around that size. There was an Air Force study a study done by several current members of the Air Force who suggested 311, a very precise number, and we could carry out all the military missions with 311, which was actually fewer weapons than some of the organizations that Plowshare supports, like the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Federation of American Scientists, who have come out with a force of around 500. The current Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, issued a report several years ago, just last year actually, with a former commander of the Strategic Command and the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Jim Cartwright, that suggested 450 active plus 450 in reserve. So those kinds of numbers, you know, several hundred, seems to be around what many military and national security experts think would be an adequate force that could satisfy all our deterrent needs.
I think one of the things that we need a real public discussion about before we choose the number is how would they be used? And what is your intended goal by having these weapons if you have to use them? And that should dictate how many you have. During the Cold War, there was a real belief that we needed to disable the Soviet war-making machinery to protect the United States. And that meant that the numbers needed to continue to grow as the Soviets got more airfields, as the Soviets got more missile silos. And that's how we wound up with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. But we were going to primarily try to attack their military targets. Now, as a result of doing that, we were going to wipe out their civilization as well. But right now, when you think of the numbers of nuclear weapons, I think we need a real discussion about, well, what is a nuclear weapon useful for as a weapon? Not as a deterrent, not as a psychological argument against attacking us, but what do nuclear weapons do effectively? They're most effective at killing civilians, at killing large numbers of civilians quite efficiently. So in your cold and brutal calculation, you need to think about, well, how many of our enemies' cities do we need to threaten to destroy in order to persuade them not to attack us? That's at the heart of classic deterrence theory. So would Russia accept losing Moscow and St. Petersburg and three other cities? Well, if that's the number, then you only need 8 to make sure you destroy those cities. There's been so little discussion about what these weapons are actually for. So when you talk about having 300 weapons or 400 weapons, that's a strategy of minimum deterrence or finite deterrence. And what it does is it allows you to have a small number of nuclear weapons, but then if you have to actually use them, you're going to use them against cities, you're going to use them against civilians. And that's one of the strong humanitarian arguments against having any nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. The whole thrust of American military policy for the last few decades has been to minimize civilian casualties. And I'm not saying that we've always done a good job of it, but our armed forces right now are seeking precision weapons that will destroy military targets and not have collateral damage. And nuclear weapons are the opposite of that. So I think in order to decide the right number, we need to have a real discussion about, well, what are they for? And
That discussion hasn't happened in the United States for decades.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guests are Joe Cirincione, president of the Global Security Foundation Plowshares Fund, and Eric Schlosser, noted investigative journalist, who are discussing how to reduce the possibility of a conflict or accident involving nuclear weapons. I'd like to turn to a rather specific issue, and one of the nuclear nightmares that Joe Cirincione writes about in his book. That's nuclear proliferation, but in particular, the case of Iran and Iran's nuclear program. Your book is very clear on the issue of Iran, but you finished it before the interim agreement. History has this way of overtaking authors. And I'm very interested to know how you see this. You make a strong point in the book that people talk about countries like North Korea and Iran, but actually there, and you say, and I think rightly, there aren't countries like North Korea and Iran. There are North Korea and Iran. And if some deal could be done which made sure that Iran was not going to get nuclear weapons, that would be a major boost to the cause of non-proliferation, nuclear non-proliferation.
In fact, I call the chapter "The End of Proliferation."
Yeah.
You know, there used to be many more countries who either had nuclear weapons programs or were trying to get nuclear weapons programs, and because of persistent American policy, in large extent, run by liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, we've whittled away these. We've knocked them off one by one, and we're down to the last two hard cases. North Korea is a particularly difficult case. Let's put that aside for now. Iran is the one that's up and has more resonance among the American public than any other nuclear threat. This is not the greatest nuclear threat we face. They don't have nuclear weapons yet. You know, but 70% of all the news stories about nuclear weapons in the American press are about Iran. So when the American public thinks about nuclear threats, they think about Iran. And it's a very important issue for us. If we can resolve this, if we can verifiably end the threat of an Iranian nuclear weapons program, you will have solved one of the most difficult problems, and you then open up the path for it makes it easier to resolve some of your other difficult nuclear policies. So can you do that? We don't know. We don't know. Can you trust Iran to give up their weapons? No. You cannot trust Iran. So that's why the deal that we're negotiating has nothing to do with trust. It's about a verifiable commitment to cease and desist in a certain set of behaviors that could give Iran the capability to build a nuclear weapon, the capability to quickly break out from what's supposed to be a civilian program and build a nuclear weapon. We have an interim deal that has frozen Iran's uranium enrichment program at this point in many aspects and has rolled it back in some. And we're going to work very hard over the next 6 months to see if we can turn that into a final deal that puts Iran's program in an iron box. It won't end it. It won't eliminate the threat. But can you put it in a box and assure that if Iran breaks out, that you can see it and you have the option to take various actions that could then deal with that? It's not very often that you get to see the hinge of history move. I think we may be in one of those moments where we're seeing something that people have been trying to do for over 10 years and now may be able to do. Let's give the diplomats the time and the tools they need to get that job done. They don't need more sanctions piled on by the U.S. Senate. They don't need people nipping at their heels, second-guessing them, undercutting their efforts. Give the diplomats 6 months to see if we can get a deal. If we can't, we have other options we can consider.
Eric, I have a question related to your, specifically to your analysis of the command and control system. And the question is, why do we still have so many ICBMs on a high state of alert in the U.S. and in Russia? Doesn't this seem...
It is a holdover from the Cold War. And it makes no sense whatsoever. And one of the real problems with command and control and the management of the arsenal is, on the one hand, there is this mentality that you want your weapons always available for immediate use. So we've kept our missiles in the heartland ready to be launched within minutes. But at the same time, you never want one of them launched accidentally. You never want one of them sabotaged or used by an officer without permission. And the administrative and the technological controls that you for these two competing goals are often at odds with one another. So having missiles on alert is a legacy of the Cold War. It was this notion that we wanted to be able to use our missiles before they were destroyed by our enemy. But the likelihood of Russia launching a nuclear strike at the United States at our land-based missiles is highly, highly remote when we have huge ballistic missile submarines that have the majority of our nuclear-tipped missiles beneath the sea that could retaliate and destroy Russia right now. I think one of the real greatest threats that this country faces right now is the fact that both the United States and Russia still have these land-based missiles on alert, ready to be used on short notice, and that creates all kinds of possibilities for accidents, misunderstandings, problems in communications, and that would be one of the first places that I would start in building a stronger relationship with Russia, would be to take these missiles off of alert. And there are people who argue that we don't even need land-based missiles anymore. The land-based missiles that we have currently are pretty much useful only for attacking Russia. If we wanted to attack China or other countries, these missiles would have to fly over Russia, and we can't expect Russia to be happy about having nuclear warheads fly over their territory to go elsewhere. So these really are an outmoded 20th century weapon, and particularly when they are kept on full-time 24-hour alert.
One of the questions that a number of people have put from the audience is, can we get rid of nuclear weapons if we still have a nuclear power industry?
It's harder, but it's certainly doable. And in Plowshares Fund has a board of directors that have different opinions on this issue. Some see nuclear power as a pact with the devil. Others see it as a necessary bridge technology to combat global warming. There's no question that countries that have nuclear power programs can use some of that technology and perhaps in some cases, and this is the case with Iran, enrichment technology to make fuel rods and to make nuclear weapons. So whenever you have nuclear power technology present, you have a risk. But we have developed mechanisms that can reduce the risk, that can monitor those facilities, that can make it much harder for countries to break out from that. I think the key here is that insofar as you need nuclear power, just make sure that everything you do to combat one global threat doesn't make the other global threat worse.
Can you elaborate on that? You mean you make the climate change global warming threat worse.
So a number of people believe that there's no way that you can reduce the carbon emissions in this planet without a healthy wedge, this is the word, of nuclear power, at least for the next 50 years or so. Other people dispute that, but that's a completely reasonable argument. So if you're going to expand the number of nuclear power stations in the world, you have to do something about the fuel supply. Find ways to make sure that the countries who are building nuclear power plants have a source of the fuel that doesn't require them to build their own enrichment facilities or reprocessing facilities. And there are a series of proposals and a series of ways to do that. You want to stop if a country like Vietnam, for example, case in point, if Vietnam's negotiating a nuclear cooperation treaty with the United States, they want to build nuclear power stations. Great. They also want to reserve the right to have their own enrichment. Bad. So you want to be able to negotiate treaties and a trade agreements that let people enjoy the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, but restrict their ability to transfer that peaceful use to military purposes.
And in the just to follow up again, in the case of Iran, So Iran will keep, at least it has said, that it is not willing to give up enrichment, right? So if there's to be an agreement with Iran, there will be some level of uranium enrichment.
So Eric, you might want to weigh in on this, but in 10 years ago, Iran didn't have any centrifuges spinning. They weren't enriching uranium. Now they have about 11,000 centrifuges actually enriching uranium and another 9,000 ready to add to that. We could have gotten a deal 10 years ago to have no centrifuges. Maybe we could have gotten a deal 7 years ago to have no centrifuges. We probably could have gotten a deal 5 years ago to have several hundred centrifuges. You can't get that deal now. The regime has invested so much money and political capital in this program, there isn't a politician in Iran that could possibly agree to shut the whole thing down. But you could probably get a deal to severely limit it. Limits on the number of centrifuges, the quality of the centrifuges, the location of the centrifuges, inspections to make sure that they're only being used for these, so-called production of fuel. You can probably get that deal. And in doing that, you might be able to open the door to the withering away of this program, because ultimately it doesn't make any sense for Iran to have that kind of capability. They don't need it. They can buy all the fuel they need from Russia or other suppliers. You want to give them a face-saving way out. So even though a zero enrichment for Iran would be a much better deal, you can't let the best be the enemy of the good. There's a diplomatic compromise deal that you can get now. Let's not blow that opportunity.
One of the points that you both stress in your books in somewhat different ways is the importance of openness, transparency, and accountability. And I think, Eric, your book, you mentioned the Soviet Union denying there were nuclear warheads on the submarine, but you give a number of examples of Strategic Air Command or the Air Force denying or at least not being willing to say whether there were nuclear warheads on a particular missile that had or on a particular bomber. And you stress how important this is, the publicity or at any rate openness about what is actually going on. Could you say, you don't say a great deal about it in your book, but at the very end it's a rather impassioned point that you make. And I'm wondering how crucial you see that in terms of breaking down the mentalities that carry over from the Cold War and so on.
A great many lies were told by our government during the Cold War in the interest of national security. That's how it was justified. In my book, I look at some of the safety problems that we had with our nuclear weapons that were publicly denied, that when there would be an accident, there would be a dismissal that there was any possibility of a nuclear detonation. And what happened is that there was such intense secrecy in this country and compartmentalized secrecy even within the military and the weapons community that the secrecy made the problems worse and actually made the weapons more dangerous. The weapons designers were not being told about problems that the military was having in the field with these weapons. And the military in the field, the guys who were handling these weapons on a day-to-day basis, often didn't know some of the safety issues that the weapons designers had become concerned about. So this intense secrecy actually made the risk much greater. Now that the Cold War is over, I think we need a very open discussion of what happened so that going forward we can learn from many of these mistakes. Of all the national security issues that deserve a certain amount of secrecy today, I think nuclear weapons would probably be at the top. The designs of our weapons today, how some of their delivery vehicles work, of course that should be secret. But in my Freedom of Information Act requests, I found again and again that what was being kept secret was information that was just going to embarrass national security bureaucracies. And for too long, what I believe to be one of the most important subjects in this country, nuclear weapons, nuclear strategy, the management of our arsenal, has been controlled by a small group of policymakers in Washington largely, acting in secret. And the time has come for us once again to have a real debate on these issues, to have an application of democracy to these issues, and it's the secrecy and the excessive secrecy that endangered us. And as we learned from the Snowden case, when you have too many secrets, they're hard to keep. So I would argue fewer secrets, tightly kept.
Let me just add to that that the secrecy extends to the cost of these weapons. We do not know how much the nuclear weapons cost because the government's not required to outline the full lifetime cost of programs that it's proposing. And as everyone who's been involved in government procurement knows, you always underestimate how much it's going to cost, and you start off with a very small initial payment, so then you can lock the program in, and as the costs escalate, you're stuck with it. This is why the Congressional Budget Office and the Monterey Institute both share the same single recommendation. It's time for the government to produce a unified long-term nuclear deterrent budget so we can know how much these weapons are cost. Only then can we make informed choices. What are we giving up militarily in order to buy these weapons? Would we be better off buying more conventional weapons, paying our troops more, taking care of veterans' pensions, than we would investing in these obsolete weapons from an era long gone? You can see where I come down on that issue.
But I'm also interested in how you think about the public and openness and who is responding to these things. Is it Joe, you go into that a little bit more than Eric does. I think Eric exposes the harm that secrecy has done, I think, very clearly. Joe, you're president of a foundation that's aiming to educate people about the dangers and to have an impact on policy. So are you satisfied with the state of the debate in the country at the moment? Because Eric clearly is not satisfied with the state of the debate.
No.
And what can be done to generate the kind of the debate that you think would be healthy?
Well, nuclear policy is not, again, going to be a front-page debate the way it was in the 80s, for example, when you had a million people in Central Park protesting the U.S. and Soviet nuclear policies. It's not going to be a mass movement. What you do see, however, is this emerging bipartisan consensus among the American security elite that whatever security benefits these weapons may have had during the Cold War is now outweighed by the liabilities they present. That debate can be helped by the government coming forth with more information, just as Eric suggested, on what these weapons are for, how they would be used, what would be the consequences of their use. So this is built into the discussion, and it's not all fuzzed over with words like deterrent and keeping America strong and necessary to prevent. You know, let's be real about what we're actually talking about and then put some cost figures on there. And you see some members of Congress trying to do this. From the state of California, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's the head of a key Senate committee on this, is constantly waging a battle to try to get accurate cost estimates for some of the programs that are being proposed. For example, a program to modernize the B-61 bomb. B-61 means nothing to you. It's a bomb we built during the Cold War to drop on Europe. It was a tactical weapon to try to stop the Warsaw Pact advance. We used to have thousands of them. We have about 200 left. There's a proposal to spend $11 billion to modernize this B-61 bomb. You could build this weapon out of solid gold, and it would cost less than this program is suggesting. And Senator Feinstein is one of those who's irate about this, trying to do something about it. Senator Durbin from Illinois is the head of another key committee on this, trying to get accurate cost estimates and, at the same time, accurate judgments of what do we need all these weapons? Why do we have a program to build 12 new nuclear-armed ballistic submarines? Would 10 do? Would 8 do? So requiring studies like that, what's the point? Do we really need 800 hydrogen bombs in submarines in the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean in 2050, in 2060? And is it worth sacrificing the conventional ships we can't build in order to get those nuclear ships? Those are the kinds of debates you need to have. And when politicians raise those, they should be rewarded. So people should be thanking Senator Feinstein and Senator Durbin for raising those questions, encouraging them to go further.
I've had one question which says, the questioner says that he or she receives lots of messages and mail from Plowshares Fund, also from Global Zero, from different organizations. Mm-hmm. Why so many messages from different organizations?
Because they all need money.
But would the money not be spent, I think, the implication, would the money not be used better if there were greater coordination?
This is actually one of the – read the last chapter of Nuclear Nightmares, because it's all about actually the quite extensive coordination that exists among all the groups working for a more rational nuclear policy. It's understandable that there's always going to be dozens of groups. Everybody wants to have their own organization doing their own thing. The Nuclear Threat Initiative, a fine foundation headed by Sam Nunn and Ted Turner. There are big corporate foundations like the MacArthur Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation. There are different groups like Global Zero, Federation of American Scientists. All of these groups are working together. What we've been doing at Plowshares in cooperation with our other foundations is building a network that can unify them, that can agree on a set of common goals that we can all push for. We can synchronize message, making sure we're not spending money on the same thing at the same time, and pull that together. That's exactly what we did do in the New START Treaty. We think it helped get that treaty ratified. That's what we're doing on Iran to stop Iran from getting a bomb and stop a new war in the Middle East. You're seeing, actually, I think there's a lot more cooperation around the nuclear policy groups than you see in many other worthy movements such as the environmental human rights movements.
And what then, if there's a consensus emerging in the U.S., how far do you think this can become an international consensus? Because, after all, nuclear weapons are possessed by, you know, more than the United States. The dangers and the difficulties and the near misses and the accidents that have taken place in the U.S. We know much less about these in other countries, mm-hmm. but we, I think, can make a good guess that there have been similar accidents. How can we get an emerging consensus, as it were, an international consensus about getting out of the nuclear situation?
I think that there is a growing movement that is emerging, that is focusing on some of the humanitarian impacts and is using as a model the international treaties to ban cluster munitions and landmines as a way of looking at nuclear weapons. Well, what are these really for and at whom will they be aimed? The place that gives me the greatest concern, and I think Joe as well right now, is Pakistan and India.
Yeah.
Where they are recreating in many ways our arms race with the Soviet Union, but they're doing it with a contiguous border and intense hatred that only neighbors can have for one another. We were angry at the Soviet Union, but they were 6,000 miles away, and that made it a little easier. So I think, I hope that it doesn't take a catastrophic accident in India or Pakistan or the theft of a weapon or the detonation of a weapon, for those countries to realize the danger that they're putting themselves in. And I may be naive, but I this is why I'm a writer. I think that as knowledge and awareness spreads worldwide, it can have an impact. And again, earlier we talked about how the Cold War ended, how apartheid ended in this country, how segregation ended. Big, powerful institutions that seem overwhelming can vanish very quickly, but it takes awareness and then it takes the desire for people to change things.
I think I have time for one last question. And this it follows on from what you've just said. You both alerted us to great dangers. And you've both spoken about optimism. And your last comments are very eloquent. And Joe talked about the hinge of history. Are you optimistic? Do you think it is back on luck, or is it really more on us and what we do? It's not divine intervention, but it's human intervention that may be crucial.
I'm very optimistic about our ability to reduce these risks. I think this is where history is going. There are fewer countries pursuing these weapons. There are fewer weapons, nuclear weapons in the world today. The trend is clearly down. It's just a question of whether we can get low enough before something truly terrible happens. And as Sam Nunn says, we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe. So that's why I wake up every morning thinking about nuclear weapons. And this is why, you know, so many of us who are in this room, you know, are trying to do something about it. We see the urgency. We see the threat. You know, we're not ignoring this problem. I don't know whether we're going to be able to get these numbers down low enough, quick enough.
I just spent 6 years deeply immersed in the minutiae of nuclear weapons and the plans for nuclear war, and it did not leave me feeling depressed, apocalyptic, or doomed, and I'm not heavily medicated either. But it did leave me deeply concerned, and it left me feeling this is an urgent issue that must be addressed. And one of the things about Iran for me is not that Iran having a nuclear weapon poses an imminent threat. It's that Iran getting a nuclear weapon overturns the non-proliferation regime that has been so successful and that has persuaded so many countries not to develop nuclear weapons. If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, I'm fearful of an arms race in the Middle East where there are intense, deep sectarian hatreds, and where we're seeing right now with the use of conventional weapons a desire to deliberately target civilians, kill as many civilians as possible. So that's why I feel very strongly that Iran should not get nuclear weapons and that it's in their own interest not to have them. So I'm deeply concerned, but I don't feel any of this is inevitable.
Our thanks to Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, and to Eric Schlosser, noted journalist and author of the book Command and Control. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of our guests' books are on sale in the lobby, and they will be pleased to sign them outside this room immediately following the program. We appreciate your letting them make their way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm David Holloway, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you, Eric.
That was a real pleasure. Yeah, thank you, David. Thank you.